I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Jacqueline Woodson has said she loved to write as a little girl, the feeling of making the letters and watching them magically become words. She's also said she loved to tell stories when she was young, to tell lies and watch her friends react with wide-eyed wonder. Well, Woodson has taken those skills and become a prolific and award-winning writer. She's written picture books for kids, fiction for young adults, poetry, and she won a National Book Award for her memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. And she's got a new book, a novel for adults. Her second one, it's called Another Brooklyn. It's about a woman named August, an anthropologist who goes back to Brooklyn for her father's funeral. And that taps into a stream of memories about being a teenager in Bushwick in the 1970s, living with her father and younger brother. She yearns for her missing mother and develops a deep and intense bond with three neighborhood girls. Jacqueline Woodson joins us on Radio Times to talk about her new book, to talk about writing and her life. And it's a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, so good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. When you're writing a book for adults, for an older audience, do you think differently about a story, the characters, the words you use, even who you think is reading?
I don't think so much in terms of who will be reading it, but I think a lot about the voice. And I think about the fact that when I'm writing with an adult as the main character, that character can look back on a childhood where as young people can't look into their adult selves because they've never been that. They haven't yet been adults. So in that way, I feel like I can play more with time. But I do think young people will come to adult literature.
You write about the fact that this was a story kind of working on you, I guess, for a while. In what way? I mean, I'm assuming most stories work on their writer.
Yeah, I never know what I'm going to say until I begin saying it. So I didn't know what this book was becoming, but I knew I wanted to put the history of Bushwick on the page. It was the neighborhood I had grown up in, and I was watching it change very rapidly and become this other neighborhood, this another Brooklyn. And I really wanted people to have a sense that this was a place with thriving people before it got, quote unquote, discovered. And so I knew I was going to write about Bushwick. I knew I also wanted to write about the intimacy of friendships among and between girls. And so with those two narratives in my brain, I began putting the story down.
Well, in fact, you dedicate this book. Often books are dedicated to people, but you dedicate this for Bushwick, 1970-1990 in memory.
Exactly. For that reason that I do want that period to be remembered.
Well, I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your new book, Another Brooklyn.
For a long time, my mother wasn't dead yet. Mine could have been a more tragic story. My father could have given in to the bottle or the needle or a woman and left my brother and me to care for ourselves, or worse, in the care of New York City Children's Services, where, my father said, there was seldom a happy ending. But this didn't happen. I know now that what is tragic isn't the moment. It is the memory. If we had had jazz, would we have survived differently? If we had known our story was a blues with a refrain running through it, would we have lifted our heads, said to each other, this is memory, again and again until the living made sense? Where would we be now if we had known there was a melody to our madness? Because even though Sylvia, Angela, Gigi, and I came together like a jazz improv, half notes tentatively moving toward one another until the ensemble found its footing and the music felt like it had always been playing, we didn't have jazz to know this was who we were. We had the top 40 music of the 1970s trying to tell our story. It never quite figured us out.
I just love the beginning of this book. And to be about melody and memory, the sort of combining of those two. As you said, I know now that what is tragic isn't the moment, it's the memory. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? It's so provocative, I have to say.
When we're existing inside of our experiences, we're not necessarily experiencing them, right, until that moment when we look back on that experience and begin to deconstruct it, begin to unpack it. And I think that that's when we start realizing what was tragic about it or what was traumatic about it. But I think it is that kind of protection mechanism that gives in when we're in the moment of having an experience that allows us to get through that experience. So then looking back, we have that memory.
So we only, in a sense, understand it when we remember it or think about it after it's done?
Yeah, I think so.
There is this, I don't want to give too much away, but August is really haunted by the absence of her mother. Her father's moved her and her brother to New York, and she desperately misses her mother, believes mm-hmm. that if, and she goes looking for her, thinks about her all the time. And I think, I don't know if this is an overgeneralization or not, but I think oftentimes we read about or hear about father absence, the absence mm-hmm. of fathers, especially on young boys. But this is about mother absence. Mm-hmm. What did you want to explore, understand with that?
A couple of things. I think in terms of the father, I think the representation of fathers as single fathers is not depicted too often in literature, especially the representation of responsible, protective Black fathers. I think the stereotype is often that of the absent father, of the absent Black father. And I didn't want to recreate that stereotype. I would love to get it off the page. And I also wanted to show, as you said, August's longing for her mother, for that female figure in her life, and what it means to have a deep denial around loss, which is what August has.
Well, I know that you wrote your memoir, after your mother had died, and I wonder mm-hmm. whether you're still exploring that absence, that loss, through fiction.
I think there is a lot of grief. I think there's a lot of grief that is in Another Brooklyn, and that was in Brown Girl Dreaming. I think one of the things in Brown Girl Dreaming, the memoir, I was exploring in terms of that sadness was my mom left because she left us with our grandparents, our very loving grandparents, in Greenville, South Carolina, to go to New York to find a place to live because our family was a part of that great migration. And there was the missing of her when she had to go to New York. So that was that first sense of her being gone and longing for her, and then her coming back and the reunion, and then her moving us to New York City. So in Another Brooklyn, when I begin to explore with August, I can bring to it that deep sadness right. of my mother's final physical loss from us, and also the one where she returned. So August is like, she's coming tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And August keeps that hope with her that her mother will return. And of course, in the process, is denying something that's very deep.
I'm going to make a weird segue, but I just have to say to you and to our listeners that the National Book Award finalists have been announced, and you, Jacqueline Woodson, are a finalist for the book that we're talking about, Another
yay.
Brooklyn. So yay, congratulations.
Thank you.
And then we'll move on with our interview, a little interlude there. What I also love from the way you write is August and her younger brother looking out the window. I mean, the father sort of creates this perch for them so that they can look at the world. And they've come up from the South. He mm-hmm. wants them to be safe. But they want to know the world that they live in.
Uh-huh.
And they're the two of them are looking at the world from this window.
Yeah.
Kind of a lens.
It's another gaze. So there are so many ways in which the book talks about the gaze. And here they are from this high up window looking down on the world and longing for that world down there. And not only is it that they're looking up at it from a window, but it's a window that's been painted shut. So they have no access to, they don't even have access to the sound that's coming from that world until their father finally cuts through the paint and raises the window, and suddenly music and the sounds of the kids screaming and all of this starts coming in. And that's the first phase of them getting free. Eventually he lets them go downstairs to the gate, and then he eventually lets them roam the neighborhood. But he was a kid who grew up in Brooklyn himself, and a guy who eventually went to Vietnam. And for him, he doesn't feel like the world is safe. And so he's also coming from Sweet Grove, Tennessee, and what happened in Tennessee, he wants to really, really right. protect his children.
You mentioned Vietnam, and it does figure in this book. August's mom's brother, so her uncle, died in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, her father fought in Vietnam, missing fingers. He was mm-hmm. missing fingers off his hands.
And wouldn't talk about it.
And wouldn't talk about it as well. Were you interested in particular about exploring the impact of that war on African-American men?
I was, and I've always been fascinated by Vietnam. I think one of the reasons that's so is because my family was Jehovah's Witnesses, so they were conscientious objectors. I have such a hard time saying that. I can say CO. And so we didn't have family members who went to war. I never knew anyone who joined the Army as a young child and then came back some kind of way. In a way, I was looking at it from a distance. But what I did see were the strangers who came back to the neighborhood from Vietnam and were addicted to heroin or had PTSD before people were really calling it PTSD. And then later on, as I researched the war, realizing how many people of color were killed in that war and how devastating that was to our community.
And came home, as you said, wounded in some kind of way. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're still engaged in wars, and I think we're more sensitive, more aware about the impact of war on a soldier or on a Marine. But back in the Vietnam War, a very different situation.
Mm-hmm. I think here we're more clued in on not only the impact of on the soldier, but on the soldier's family, how it really impacts a whole community. When you look at Vietnam and you look at people who are dependent on an income that doesn't come in, right? Because here are these men coming back home and being dependent rather than independent and not being able to help pull the family out of the poverty that they're already in. August's dad was able to come back home and actually hold a job down and support his kids and raise his kids and get his kids to college.
But he's missing these fingers. I mean, I'm curious about why you chose that. I mean, there are many ways he could be wounded, but, you know, we need our hands, right?
We need our hands, and we can live without parts of them. And the thing about it is I could have had a missing toes and giving him a limp, but I wanted something that was visible because I wanted to talk about longing. And at one point, when he's at mosque and the women see his missing hands and they see this handsome guy, and he must need them because they're attracted to him. And so I wanted to show it in a I didn't want to disfigure him, his face or anything. It felt that the best thing to do is to show these hands and also to show that even with these missing fingers, he's a very able human being.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Jacqueline Woodson is our guest. She's got a new book, a novel called Another Brooklyn, and again, just announced as a finalist for a National Book Award. She won the National Book Award for her memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. And we're talking about some of the characters, the ideas, the fact that Brooklyn Bushwick is a character in her new novel. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Jacqueline Woodson about her new book, her novel called Another Brooklyn. It's about a young woman named August. She's an anthropologist. She goes back to her childhood home of Bushwick and in Brooklyn. Her father has died. She's there for the funeral, and being there unlocks all sorts of memories. And Woodson has said that she mined her teenage years for the book that's about the deep bond between four girls navigating their adolescence in this particular neighborhood. And Jacqueline, I'd love to have you read another section from the book where August sees these three girls that she's been watching for a while.
Hey. It was during this summer that I first saw Sylvia, Gigi, and Angela. The three of them walked down our block, dressed in halter tops and shorts, arms linked together, heads thrown back, laughing. I watched until they disappeared, wondering who they were, how they became. My mother had not believed in friendships among women. She said women weren't to be trusted. "Keep your arm out," she said, "and keep women a whole other hand away from the furthest tips of your fingernails." She told me to keep my nails long. But as I watched Sylvia, Angela, and Gigi walk past our window, I was struck with something deeply unfamiliar, a longing to be a part of who they were, to link my own arm with theirs and remain that way forever.
Can you read a little bit more? Sorry, yeah.
Another week passed and they appeared again, this time stopping below our window, untwining and doubling a long line of telephone cable. Gigi and Angela turning as Sylvia stood just outside the double ropes, rocking back and forth on the balls of her feet before jumping in. I watched them, my mouth slightly open, intrigued by the effortlessness of flow of them, how each moved so the other could continue moving.
Again, just a beautiful passage, and she makes friends with them, and you talk about the gaze, the looking at other people, and when she finally makes contact with them, one of them says to her, "What have you been looking at? Why are you interested in this gaze?"
I think it is something that is kind of taboo in our society, right? There is not that allowance for looking, for taking people in, and or for studying them. And of course, August goes on to become an anthropologist because she's always watching and so intrigued by the other. And I think that that sense of other is what has gotten our country in so much trouble. So I think in writing Another Brooklyn and really looking at the various gazes, the gaze, Caribbean blacks versus African Americans, you know, young girls and old men, fathers and sons, believers and non-believers, and white folks and black folks, all these ways in which people are kind of forced into these spaces where they have to regard each other, but at the same time, not really allowed to do so.
And regard each other, meaning just really look at, I mean, scan each other.
Yeah, and take each other in. And as a means, I mean, the end of it means a deeper understanding. And when one thing that happens with the girls is, what I'm investigating is that the physicality, right? As girls, when you're growing up, your growing up is so visible to the world, right? You can't hide your breasts. You can't hide your body changing. And you're very, very aware of people looking at this. But you can't regard them. You can't say, "Stop looking at me," especially if you're alone, because you're too vulnerable. But these four girls together create this pack that makes them less afraid. But it is that, you know, the gaze of the shoekeeper, the gaze of the boys, the gaze of the girls at each other, the gaze of the fathers at on the girls, the gaze of, you know, even August's mother on other women. Right. So there are all these ways in which it's happening.
And girls together feel more empowered, feel less alone. What it tapped in for me was just that those intense feelings that girls have for their girlfriends when they're in their teenage years.
And
it's a love affair in many ways.
It is. It's such a deep, deep adoration. And you know, it's homoerotic. It's so deep and physical and emotional and psychological. I mean, it's everything. And it was one of the things I was thinking about when I meet grown women who say they don't have female friends. My big question is, how did that happen? And for me, as a writer, as a mom, as a person in the world, like I couldn't walk through this world without my village, without the women who help keep me standing and help raise my kids, help raise our kids, and help me write my books. And you know, we have a deep, hardcore group of people, of uncles and aunties and godmothers and people who have been in my life forever. And I brought that, the mining of that, to these four girls, and also the memory of my own childhood with my best friend Maria, who you meet in Brown Girl Dreaming, who's still a very, very, very close friend of mine. And I just couldn't imagine one day not being friends, God forbid, with any of them.
But that's also, again, without giving too much away, this is also about having those friends and then what happens 20 years later, what happens to those friendships, what happens to the girls as they become women.
Yeah, and what happens when friends break up, what happens when friends break your heart, you know, all of that can happen when you have an intimate relationship.
Did you have a bunch of girlfriends kind of thing, or just your one kind of soulmate as a teenage girl?
I did. I had both. I had my really close. And it's interesting because in Bushwick, we had our school friends who didn't necessarily live in a neighborhood. Then we had our neighborhood friends who we had known longer. Like Maria, I've known since the 60s. And then I have friends who I met in high school. I have friends who I met in middle school. And then I have my college friends, right? But there were definitely pockets of people who impacted my life in different ways. And most of them, the ones that are still living, I'm still pretty much in touch with.
So they're your village? I mean, you feel like your village is sort of intact?
Yes, thankfully. Thankfully.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jacqueline Woodson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She has written more than 30 books, including picture books for young kids, fiction for young adults, poetry. She's the Young People's Poet Laureate. She's also a National Book Award winner for her memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, that came out just a couple of years ago, and just literally named finalist for a National Book Award for her book that we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times, Another Brooklyn. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So does it ever get old to be nominated for a prestigious book award?
So, no.
No.
So this is the fourth time I've been a finalist for the National Book Award. And you know, just getting the call, I was screaming. Basically, it's the award for that book, right? It has nothing to do with the work you're trying to do now or the work you're going to do in the future. And so to have created this book and to have someone say it's that kind of a book is mind-blowing. And that even the doubt that a writer has in oneself, that doesn't really go away, right?
You would even think, after 30 books?
No, because those are those 30 books. It has nothing to do with book 31 or 32. So, and it's, the question is, can I tell this story, and will I be able to tell it in a way that's going to be meaningful to me and then by extension to the world?
So how long have you known you are a finalist?
Since yesterday.
Oh, since yesterday. Okay, so that was when all the screaming took place?
Uh-huh.
Your book, and it's true with some of your other books as well, and I have to say as a reader, it allows the reader to sort of pause. I mean, you have, I'm looking here, this doesn't work particularly well on the radio, but there's a paragraph, a couple of sentences, a big space, then a couple of lines, then another paragraph, a big space, couple of lines, obviously by design.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that comes from poetry, from being a poet, or something about how the words look on a page.
It's all of that. The white space is very intentional. And the white space is there, just like it is in poems, to talk about, to ask the reader to just slow down a minute and take this in, go back and read this again, and let it get absorbed before moving on. It's not a book that's meant to be read really quickly. Mm-hmm. So when people say they read it in one sitting, I'm like, just go back and read it again, because you're going to miss a lot of what's very implicit in the same way that poetry happens. And so the words are very intentional. Getting to the tautness of the novel comes from reading and writing a lot of poetry. But it's its own process. Everything I write, I read out loud. It has a sound a certain way. It has a look a certain way on the page. With Brown Girl Dreaming, it was written in verse, and at one point they messed up the line breaks, and I was like,
really?
There's a reason why I broke the lines that way. Yeah, so we had to go back in. And here it is, the paragraph is the moment. I take you into the moment and slowly bring you out of it, and the next paragraph connects to that moment, but sometimes in a different way, even with the way that August is studying death and dying after when she becomes an anthropologist. At the end of the passages where I talk about different rituals that different cultures have around death and dying, it has something to do what you've just experienced with the characters on the page. So it is all very intentional.
Well, that's so interesting because as I was reading, doing my homework in preparation for the interview, and I quoted this when I introduced you, the fact that as a little girl, you love the act of writing. I mean, you said this, which is just, you know, making the letters and the letters become words. And that's all, I mean, I can see that, what a little girl thought about writing and how that shows up in a in an adult book.
In every book I write, it shows up because words are so important to me. Not too many. I think that one of the things people get taught in writing school is kill your darlings, right? So you find a sentence and it's so beautifully written that it just has to be there, right? It has nothing to do with the narrative. And so it actually ends up slowing the narrative down or being destructive to the narrative, but people are like, but it's such a beautiful sentence. And so I don't have that going on. I mean, I'm very happy to throw stuff away to kill the darlings that aren't working, but I do want the language on the page to flow in a certain way and to read well. And I want, when people to read it, to kind of get caught up in that dream of fiction as they're reading it.
I mean, should we think of fiction as a form of telling whoppers? I mean,
I mean,
it is. It's fiction, of course. It's made up.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is a lot of lies on the page, but it's also a lot of truth on the page, right? Because I think what writers write to get at is a bigger truth, and sometimes a greater good. And so, it's an investigation. So when I start to write, it's about investigating something that I don't know, and then by the end, I don't always have the answer, but I'm satisfied.
You write at the very end of this book, a writer writes to hold on, to hold on to what memories
to everything. In another Brooklyn, I want to hold on to Bushwick, and I want people to hold on to it, and I want people to understand the history of the places where we live, and not forget that, you know, our country that we live in now once belonged to Native people, right? That our First Lady said, the White House was built by enslaved people. Like, the history, I think writers are able to put history on the page and make it sometimes not so comfortable for people, sometimes more comfortable for people, but on the page it exists and it's telling that truth. Even in Another Brooklyn, which is fiction, there's a lot of truth to friendship. There's a lot of truth to Vietnam. There's a lot of truth with Biafra and Bushwick and fatherhood and girlhood. So, but it is couched in this kind of narrative.
Well, and what's so interesting about your description of Bushwick, and I think it's true, for people who live in places that get written about by journalists and outsiders, is a totally different experience. I mean, outsiders don't see what life is like.
And it's funny because when I was going back to research Bushwick, because there was a lot I had forgotten and I really wanted to get it on a page, I had grown up with it being called, you know, a ghetto, a slum, the inner city. I'm sure now that I would have called it urban. All those words that people use instead of telling the truth about a neighborhood, or what they think is the truth about a neighborhood, about the fires of Bushwick, because there are a lot of wood frame houses that caught on fire, about the street gangs, about the poverty. And it was yet another gaze that was so on the outside of the existence of the people who live there. And I always think, you know, you throw a rock, you can hit 10 Jacqueline Woodsons in neighborhoods like Bushwick. And some of us get opportunities. Some of us take a writing class and there's an editor in it. Some of us have a teacher in high school who say, you know what, you should write. And some of us don't get seen that way or don't have whatever it takes to take that next step. But someone on the outside looking in might not see that.
Yeah. You had a teacher, did you not, who said...
I had a couple,
You had a couple who said, you can write.
Yes, so you can write.
What did that mean to you, and how old were you?
The first time was when I was in fifth or sixth grade. I had a teacher, I had written a poem about Martin Luther King, and she didn't believe I wrote it. She thought my sister wrote it, because my sister was this brilliant scholar, gifted, all these things that she
was.
You were not gifted? I was not gifted. I wasn't seen yet, right? I think brilliance is that passion recognized. And so my passion, my brilliance wasn't yet recognized. So and at that time, brilliance, quote unquote, was academia. And so I wasn't academically gifted. But then she realized that I had written it. My mom came to school and there was a whole big thing and I ended up winning this contest. And I knew I had something then because I thought if I could write something that's so well written that someone doesn't even believe I wrote it, then I must be onto something.
But that's such a double-edged thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, to have written something that no one believed you could write.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It could have gone either way, mm-hmm. right? It could have broken my spirit. And so I think that that's something else that how do we not break the spirit of young people? And I think that that happens by seeing them. And I think a lot of kids, sadly, because of their socioeconomic status, because of the color of their skin, because of their family makeup, whatever it is, because of their, you know, preferred gender pronoun even, don't get seen. And it's a very, very dangerous thing.
But you were seen. I mean, it sounds like you were seen by several people who saw mm-hmm. you can write.
I was seen. And I think the reason I've written so many books for young people is because I want other people seen, too. Yeah. I mean, I really want young people to be seen and understood and given a chance. And we set the tone, right? As adults, we have the power to do that.
We're almost up in a break here, but did that make you a different student? A better student?
It did because I was allowed to write more as a reward for doing my work.
Were you the type that maybe didn't do their homework every night?
I did my homework, but I talked a lot in class. Oh. And my mother wouldn't let us not do our homework. So, yes, I did my homework.
But you were one of those talkers?
Yes, yes.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Jacqueline Woodson is our guest and she has written more than 30 books, many of them for young people, also for young adults. And her second novel for adults just published called Another Brooklyn and just named a finalist for a National Book Award. We are taking a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We have another reading lined up as well. And again, you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And again, I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Jacqueline Woodson about her new book. It's a novel called Another Brooklyn. I'd love to have you do another reading from your book.
But still, as we slipped deeper into 12, our breasts and butts grew. Our legs got long. Something about the curve of our lips and the sway of our heads suggested more to strangers than we understood. And then we were heading toward 13, walking our neighborhood as if we owned it. "Don't even look at us," we said to the boys, our palms up in front of our faces. "Look away, look away, look away." We pretended to believe that we could unlock arms and walk the streets alone. But we knew we were lying. There were men inside darkened hallways, around street corners, behind draped windows, waiting to grab us, feel us, unzip their pants to offer us a glimpse. We had long lost our razor blades, and none of us had ever truly stopped chewing on our nails. But still, "I and I and I and I," we chanted, "we and we and we and we." We hand sung, "Down, down, baby, down by the roller coaster, sweet, sweet baby, I'ma never let you go." Because we wanted to believe we were years and years away from sweet, sweet babies. We wanted to believe we would always be connected this way. Sylvia, Gigi, and Angela had moved far past my longest fingernail, all the way up my arm. Years had passed since I had heard my mother's voice. When she showed up again, I'd introduce my friends to her. I'd say, "You were wrong, Mama. Look at us hugging. Look at us laughing. Look how we begin and end each other."
It's so poignant. I mean, on the one part of me, I feel sad. Mm-hmm. I feel sad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe because as a reader, you can connect with the things that get lost. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of life. But somehow those intense feelings and those people get lost.
Mm-hmm. And even... The you were talking earlier about the musicality. So in that section where I put that hand singing, I think that's something else we forget about. That it's such a, it seems like such a small detail, right? Miss Mary Mack and Miss Lucy Had a Baby and all those ways that we played as children and how so much of that playing moved into early adolescence, mm-hmm. right? People were still playing with dolls when they were 11 and 12. They were still doing See a Senorita with flowers in her hair. And then suddenly it stops and some new thing is expected.
And it feels dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Threatening.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Let me get some callers in. We've got, looks like Bernadette from Roxborough joining us on Radio Times. Bernadette, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I cannot tell you how touched I am. I know that Jacqueline wrote a book about another Brooklyn, but I am from the Bushwick section. And I grew up there in 1935.
Wow.
And I left in 54 to become a missionary, so I came down to Philadelphia. But I kept always going back because my family stayed until about 75 when they moved out to Bayside. But I have such memories of my part of Bushwick. We were St. Martin of Tours Parish, so it was, you know, it was called a mixed marriage when the Irish married an Italian.
Hmm.
And my mother didn't let me hang with an Italian girl or a German girl. And yet, you know, we played with all kinds of things. And when Jacqueline just mentioned, you know, men exposing themselves, honest to God, that happened to us as
really?
Little girls.
Wow.
Right across the street from my home. And I then remembered running over with my five girlfriends. It was a Sunday morning. And my mother just comforted us all and invited everybody to bacon and eggs, you know. It's interesting to realize that we all have such very different memories of our childhood. And yet it was all our childhoods.
Sure.
And that's, you know, I'm 81 now, and she's brought me to tears. So.
I can hear it, Bernadette. No, I appreciate the call. You're very welcome. I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Thank you,
anything you
Bernadette.
Want to say in response?
So where in Bushwick were you?
We grew up in St. Martin of Tours Parish, so that would have been Weirfield Street, Halsey Street,
oh, yes.
Knickerbocker Avenue, Irving.
Yeah. So I grew up, I grew up on Madison and Knickerbocker. So, yeah,
okay.
Right. So
see,
we are.
Yeah, our A&P was over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, and Bohack.
Yes, yes.
Well, we should get you two together to reminisce together.
Thanks Bernadette. For calling, Bernadette.
Yeah, I appreciate the call.
Thank you so much for the memories.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. I mean, it must be nice when you get a call like that.
It's so great, and I love that. I know exactly where she lived, mm-hmm. which is seriously about 3 or 4 blocks away from me.
And there, I mean, this book is about so many different things, but certainly as actually Bernadette just recalled, you know, moving out in 75,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
many ways, white people moving out,
mm-hmm.
people
yeah.
of color moving in.
And I talk about that. I talk about the Italian and the Irish families moving out of the neighborhood to Queens, to Long Island, to upstate New York, and the black and Latino people moving in. And she's talking about it the time right around that same mm-hmm. time.
There's also this expression about down south. What does that mean? I mean, it means many things, I think.
In another Brooklyn, it's the place where girls got sent when they got in quote-unquote trouble. And so there was for the family to not have the shame of having a pregnant teenager in their family, or even an unwed mother, so not necessarily a teenager, they were sent to relatives down south because so many of these people had migrated north. And also, but I talk about there are all kinds of down south. Mm-hmm. There's the Dominican Republic. There's, you know, back to Trinidad. There are places where you have family that you can send the person who's going to shame the family. And when you think of the time, it wasn't a time where people really had alternatives, right? Abortion was still pretty dangerous, but also unaffordable. People, for religious reasons, weren't going to choose that option.
Yeah.
And so the girls got sent home. So the girls in the book talk about that fear of being sent to some crunchy aunt down south or a strict grandmother.
to have the baby and then figure out, I guess, what their life is going to be. Is it also a metaphor for a female body down south?
You know, it's interesting. I didn't think of that it that way. The whole book is so much about the body, right? And about the way the body is protected and unprotected and changing and not changing until eventually it's gone. And then once it's gone, as August tells us here, what different people do with it. But I guess it could definitely be that it really is about another way in which, you know, boys didn't have these consequences, right? It was the girls whose lives changed dramatically when something like this happened, and the boys were able to go back to the center of the street and play Scully and spinning tops.
And again, Jacqueline Woodson, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And again, her new book, just nominated for a National Book Award, is titled Another Brooklyn. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I see an email coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I know you were raised Jehovah's Witness. And in this book, August's brother becomes a Muslim. And her father as well. What is your interest in religion?
I grew up Jehovah's Witness, and when my uncle, who had been incarcerated, returned home, he had converted to the Nation of Islam, and so our family practiced both religions. And so I grew up in this household that was Christian and Muslim at the same time. And I didn't until I was much older know that there was fighting. You know, I just thought
between members of the family.
No, between Christians and Muslims. I thought we were all the same because in our family it was that was the blending of the religion. We had the Quran, we had the Bible. You know, we never ate pork. I still don't eat pork, and you know, we didn't celebrate Christmas. Like, there were all these ways in which religion impacted our family, and so I hadn't read about Nation of Islam, and I wrote a lot more about Jehovah's Witnesses in Brown Girl Dreaming, but I really wanted to talk about the Nation of Islam and Black Muslims, especially in a time where there's so much Islamophobia, and I think people don't see some people as people. And so the father is heading to church one day, and he comes across a Muslim brother who says, "I have a message for the black man," and so begins his becomes a Muslim, and so does the son, and so does August. But August is kind of halfway in and halfway out of the
religion.
I
noticed that. Does that reflect your ambivalence about religion?
I don't have ambivalence. It's interesting. I have a deep respect for the way people have faith and that the way people need their faith and what faith can do for people. Organized religion has never really done that for me. But I think that I really wanted to show August as a teenage girl. And here's a teenage girl, and she doesn't want to wear a hijab. She, you know, but she'll wear it sometimes. But she wants to hang with her girls. And for myself, I think I remember as a teenager, my mother not letting me wear short shorts. And so, of course, I kept a pair at my friend Diana's house next door and just went there and put them on. And that kind of the way we end up becoming teenagers and individuating is a lot of times around religion and dress and who we choose to love and all of those ways.
There's Jehovah's Witness at my train stop where I get off every morning, bright and early when I get home, as get off in the evening. Honestly, they are the nicest people. I don't, you know, it's just mostly hello, how are you kind of thing every single day.
Yeah.
We haven't really moved beyond that, but it just strikes me that just, wow.
And it's genuine. I mean, it's interesting because it's one thing that I definitely keep from having come from the South and being raised Jehovah's Witnesses, that saying hello to people and just giving people the benefit of the doubt, right? They make eye contact, they are kind, and they say good morning. But it's interesting because my daughter is always mortified. I was talking about this a couple of years ago about me saying hello to people, and I still do it. I'm not going to let that go away. But in terms of getting back to the religious aspect of it, I think in terms of being Jehovah's Witness and Muslim, I have kept stuff from both religions that I still hang on to, and they were really meaningful to me.
Well, I have to say there's a scene, August is an adult and she's home for her father's funeral, and she goes and has lunch with her brother. And the sort of the brotherly sisterly banter, the teasing, and he's a Muslim, and she's kind of like she's not so sure about it, but it's
well, very, she's sitting there eating bacon,
right, slowly in front, just taunting him and teasing him. I mean, it seemed very sibling like, and friendly,
yeah,
and comfortable.
Yeah, it's funny because I have a great uncle, my grandfather, my grandmother's brother, and his daughter. Was Muslim, Nation of Islam, and we would have these big barbecues, and he's like, I know you smell these ribs, I know you want some, and he would just tease her. It was fabulous.
We have an email from a listener saying that your book is in the Philadelphia School District curriculum, so perhaps that's Brown Girls Dreaming, taught at the Philip Randolph Technical High School.
Awesome.
I'm curious about how you write. You mentioned this earlier, and the fact that you are a poet. And the fact that for poets, I mean, obviously words matter to any writer, but certainly to a poet.
Mm-hmm.
Word seems to matter so much.
Yeah, I mean, poets work with so few words sometimes, right? So it is that intentionality. Is that why am I putting this word in this poem, but why am I placing it here in the center of the page in this poem? Let's take a look at that. And what does it mean if the word if is on its own line?
Wow.
But if it's on a line with a whole bunch of other words, if the line ends with if, what am I saying if it begins? So you really are paying attention to both structure and the words you use. And for Brown Girl Dreaming, Brown Girl Dreaming, I really wanted to use verse, and then for another Brooklyn, I wanted to try to blend the two. I wanted to try to blend the poetry and the narrative to create something different that I don't know the name for. Maybe someone has a name for what I was trying to do here.
Yeah.
But for me, it was just trying to be really intentional in terms of space, in terms of words, and weave a good narrative.
I wonder if I can squeeze Kenny on. Kenny from North Philadelphia. Almost out of time, but Kenny, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Sure. And we are almost out of time, but Kenny, but go ahead very quickly.
No, but anyway, I just wanted to comment on the fact that when she said that when she wrote her poem, whatever, a book, they thought her older sister did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've Googled it a lot. People see my work and they go, you didn't do that. I couldn't possibly have done that, you know. And it just made me feel like I can relate on that level. But I can relate on the writing part because I went to Catholic school. I know grammar, but I never read. I read like one book in high school, Farewell to Arms, that was it. But I know how to read and I know how to write and I know grammar. But I'm really into the arts and the music.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Well,
Kenny,
a bass player
as well. It sounds like you've got a full life. I appreciate Kenny. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Anything you want to say in quick response there?
I was just reading a piece by Jason Reynolds and Kirkus, and Jason is an amazing writer. He's also nominated for a National Book Award for his young people's narrative called Ghost. And one thing he said was the writers of his time were the rappers, so like Tupac Shakur and Queen Latifah and Biggie, all of them were telling the stories, and that was where he found his narrative because so many people were trying to push the canon on him.
Kenny, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jacqueline Woodson, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, her new book, it's a novel called Another Brooklyn, just announced this morning, a finalist for the National Book Award. She's also the Young People Poet Laureate. She won a National Book Award for her memoir, came out just about 2 years ago, called Brown Girl Dreaming. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.